So good morning. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Tech Days. So many people here. It's still pretty early for a developer, isn't it? Okay, who is a developer? Just checking. Just double checking. It's not a different crowd. Okay, who's not a developer? Oh, what are you doing then?
Testing.
Testing? Ah, is that part of development maybe? Could it be? Maybe. Maybe you'll feel more home after the presentation, hopefully. Yeah. So what you see here actually is the short version of the title for this presentation, because all my presentations should actually have the same title, How to Make a Customer Happy. Shouldn't that be our title for everything we do, for every activity? It could be testing or development, it still has the same goal of making our customer happy. And continuous integration, continuous delivery are parts of it, but really only parts, because I only had a text box with 120 characters. Actually, the original title was The Happy Customer Continuous Value Delivery Through Continuous Refinement of Requirements, Continuous Integration, Continuous Testing, Continuous Feedback Using Some Tool. And this is only the continuous parts, like the cycles that repeat itself all the time. If you add development and testing practices to it, it would be an even larger title, something like this maybe. Right? Now we're adding unit testing, emergent architecture, daily builds, daily stand-up. So actually, to make a customer happy, you want to give him features more frequently, features that he actually expects, and maybe they even delight him. And to do that, you have to think in shorter cycles, which sounds really easy, right? Why take 2 years to develop? Take 30 days. This is what Scrum says. You're getting the software you never wanted in 30 days and not in 2 years. This is the definition of Scrum, right? Awesome. But it's not that easy. If you have an existing architecture, you have to change many things. So in this talk, we're looking at the process. And there's a second talk where we talk about more about Agile and Scrum things and how to do emergent architecture and stuff in the afternoon, if you're interested. So yeah, I really like the title. I hope you do too. Did I miss anything in the title, actually? You're doing all that stuff, actually? Who's doing daily stand-ups regularly? Well, daily, obviously. Who's not doing them? And you still have teams? You talk to each other, but you do, right? Yeah, that's good. So now the fun part comes for me, because I actually want to check on your homework. Can anyone remember I did a session 2 years ago at this conference? And there was a homework slide. Let's go back. It was a very sunny day, actually, in this beautiful town 2 years ago. We were talking about quality, and I was urging you to define quality in your teams and showed you a few things that TFS can help you with automating that quality checks. And one of my last slides looked like this, and it was one of my last sentences where I told you, sit down in your team. Define what quality means in your team. Because if you have 10 developers, you have 20 opinions what quality is. There is, of course, we all want quality. We just can't define it. For one developer, quality is no warnings from the compiler. The other doesn't care. And the customer, he has a total different understanding of what quality might be. So you should really define it. You should come up with a list of criteria what quality means. Otherwise, what would happen if you don't define what done means to your team? It will depend on when you develop it. At the beginning of a sprint or a project, you have all the time in the world to test, for example. If you develop a feature 1 day before the release, well, we tested it a little bit less because time was running up. That should not happen, so you need a clear definition of done that you enforce in your team. It makes sense to automate that definition of done, and I showed you a few demos there. So who did actually do that? Who defined quality and came up with a definition of done? Or had it already in place without me telling you, right? Who has a definition of done in place for his team? We need to talk. Not only 10 people. Okay, you really need that list, right? Write down, like, it's checked in. Well, the simplest definition of done is it compiles, right? It's obviously not enough, but it's a nice start. So it compiles, maybe it has no warnings, it's checked in. Maybe it's checked in with a nice comment that is not called check-in, right? This is one of the two most commonly used check-in comments. What do you think what they are? Well, check-in is one of them. And the other one? Yeah, it's something like fix or bug fix or whatever, yeah. So yeah, you want to have a definition of done. You want to automatically check it. But before we can go into those technical issues, we have to deal with something more, because our input are requirements, right? And if the requirements are not right, we can be the best architects, developers, and testers in the world, and the customer gets the software and he still doesn't like it because it doesn't fulfill what it's actually supposed to do. And my favorite example is we were actually working on a project. We were spending a lot of time, including weekends, to finish up that project on time. We were really happy as developers. We liked our code. Well, most parts of our code. Some refactoring, but yeah, anyway. And we implemented a very new and modern UI. It looked like the new Outlook that just appeared, you know, the new Outlook design that came up like a couple of years ago. And there were no controls that you can buy. You actually had to build all that stuff in the UI. And then at the last day before the deployment, we actually went to the customer and we figured out how they worked. They had touch screens on the wall and they had huge pranks of hands, right? And just clapping on that screen. And now think of Outlook, where you need a mouse to do small things. The software worked, but not for this customer. He hated it. It would be nice if someone would have told us earlier. I think that would have helped. Well, we could have asked the customer at some point, is that what you actually want? It did never occur to me to ask the customer. I was just a developer. Why should I ask the customer, right? So it's a whole chain of things that can go wrong before we come to the technical parts like continuous integration and continuous delivery. This was, by the way, the step-by-step guide that I gave you 2 years ago. I said, automate your build. It takes like 5 minutes to turn on a automated build in TFS. It's one checkbox to do continuous integration, so you always build continuously after every check-in. And if you want, you can use the gated check-in that will trigger the build server first and then check it in. Then automate your testing. It starts with unit testing. You can have other quality assurance tests here, the Microsoft FX COP and Style COP. Automated deployment. This is lab management. Have you seen the new lab management features of Visual Studio 2012 in action? You know, the standard environments. Did you see that yesterday? I think there was a demo. Who's seen it? Like lab management, the new ones? Just 10 people. It takes you like 30 minutes, well, if you know where to click, obviously, but then it takes you 30 minutes to set up another machine next to your build server where all the UI tests will run. So Visual Studio installs an agent, logs in automatically to this machine, runs your tests that actually need an integration environment like UI tests, and clicks through the whole software. Well, you have to record it, right? And the deployment to that machine is automatic. If you deploy the manual script, if you manually deploy a script how to do it, then it's automatic. So it's pushing out your scripts to install your software on that test machine. So you should really look at this, and I might show you that in a couple of minutes. And number five, I left that open last time because I didn't know how the future looks like. And it's definitely talk to your customer and get the feedback loop in place. And this might also be automated because you can actually instrument your software to tell you things. Your software could tell you things like, what is the customer actually using? If there's a module he's not using a lot, should I do bug fixing a lot in that module then, or should I focus on a different area that he's actually using? So I get statistics how my users are actually using the software, and I can infer decisions for the next requirement for the next sprint. Who, by the way, is using TFS today? Most of you. Who's using the build server in TFS? It's not the same amount, but still a lot. Okay. Who's using something agile like Scrum? Who doesn't know what Scrum is? From the guys that just raised their hand? A couple, okay. So basically short cycles, right? We want to try to get something done within 2 to 4 weeks and not wait for months. And so everything happens in cycles. Let's just go step back a little bit. I have a few slides before I walk you through what I actually want to do. As you have probably seen, Visual Studio and TFS, the whole team thing started 5 or 6 years ago, where Microsoft discovered it's not only the developer that actually does work. There are other people that can help you make the customer happy or completely screw it up. Like if the requirements are bad, you cannot fix this as a developer, you will have a problem. So they started with this thing they call Team Foundation Server. 2005, 2008, there was more or less a platform. Then 2010, they added two roles, like there's somebody doing architecture, there's somebody doing testing in a team. It could be a developer or a real full-time tester. And then in the current release, there are two new roles. It's the stakeholder, which is your customer or the guy who pays the whole project, the users. And there's the operations team, like the software at some point is used by somebody. This is the not so interesting part for a developer. Like, I love the development, but when the software is running, I don't care anymore. But this is actually more time from a lifecycle perspective of a software product. So you actually want to get like exceptions automated into your software. You want to get usage statistics and all that stuff. So the operations people, or even if you as a developer are the guy installing the software and doing support, then still you want feedback here. And this is what the new version is all about. So when Microsoft showed me the beta version of Visual Studio 2012, I was really happy, because in the whole history of Microsoft, something significant had changed. At least that gave me the feeling. Look at this slide. This is a marketing slide from Beta 2. What is new in this slide, what you think is interesting? It's right in the middle. Microsoft, this is the first time we see a Microsoft slide with a customer in the middle. They found the role of a customer. Feel free to be happy now. Guess what happened then? So Microsoft changed all their slides to look more like those Metro Windows 8 style kind of apps, right? Simplify slides, simplify designs. And the marketing team was asked to simplify that slide. How can you simplify a slide? You remove things that are unnecessary, right? This is the final version of the slide. Well, I guess the real reason is obviously the stakeholder is involved everywhere in all those cycles, right? So he's not in the middle, but he's everywhere. I think this is what they try to tell us here. And if you look at continuous value delivery, there are actually three, let's call them stages, but they are all circles. Why are there circles? Because it happens all the time. There's no phase where you do requirements engineering. You're getting new requirements all the time. The customer tells you things all the time, and you need to refine those requirements all the time. This is the define phase. Then there's development. Development also doesn't stop. You're developing all the time, new features and quality at the same time. No development today, testing tomorrow. You're trying to combine that. Then at some point, you have working software, and it goes to the ops backlog, which means somebody has a backlog in the operations team too, and either they install the software or they host it, or you just do support if it's a Windows app. It really depends. And you try to monitor how is the user using the software, and you can actually ask him too. Get feedback, and that feedback will then drive your defined phase, your defined stage, your requirements, your product backlog. So if you want to look for a unit, how good you perform, you would probably say, how long do I need to actually implement something from somebody raises an idea to it's implemented? And how long does it take me from somebody raises a bug report to we actually fix it? So there are two metrics here. Cycle time, how long does it take for a new feature to be developed, and mean time to repair, how long does it take for a bug fix. And it's not just development, right? It's all the things you have to do. Because if I'm a customer, I don't care what you do in your software development. I care that I get quality, and the feature is not existent before it doesn't show up in my software, in my version of my computer, and it's usable for me. Everything in between is just waste, and the counter increases and increases. So if you call an incident, it open up an incident at Microsoft, for example, you know that the Team Foundation server is hosted online. So if you file a new request and tell them something's wrong, it doesn't work, they actually start a counter. So they have like the minutes counting for the developer, so he knows how many minutes or days they usually need to fix a bug to find out how fast or how efficient their process is. It's not about that poor developer, right, giving him like, oh, it took you 12 minutes longer than last time. It's more about finding out how efficient are we to fix a bug, or how efficient are we to add new features. And by the way, you can ask questions all the time if you want. So let's go through the whole cycle and add all the continuous delivery parts to it. Because it takes all this to be able to continuously deliver, and it's not all purely technical. So it starts with the ideas, right? And you probably know this one here. When you deliver, test, and validate exactly what the customer has asked you to, do you have a happy customer? If you get him what he asked you for? What do you think? Who thinks he will be happy if you exactly do what he told you? Who thinks that is not enough? Who has no confidence to try to raise his hand? Oh, that's a majority, right? Yes, so the first problem we have, we are supposed to get good requirements to be able to do good decisions in our architecture and coding and testing, and the customer doesn't really know what he wants. That is a problem and a challenge, ladies and gentlemen. We cannot start. Well, we can start because it worked the last 25 years, right? They said, dear developer, just start coding. We'll find requirements later, right? So it worked somehow. But customers were not always happy, and not to say delighted by your software. It was more like a, yeah, for version one, it's kind of okay. Hopefully the service pack will be out soon. And that's not our goal, right? We really want to try to find out what it is. So how do you deal with a customer that doesn't actually know what he wants? And the only solution to this problem is you have to show him the software, because if he looks at something that actually exists, he exactly knows what he does not want. Like, oh, now you're showing me the first version? This is not what I wanted. It's very easy for him to inspect something that is there that he can actually try, but it's really hard if it's just on paper or maybe just text. So you have to be very fast, get the software into a shippable state to show him the software. And even further, it would be nice if there are some misunderstandings in how the outcome should look like, that you can filter that out. And this is, obviously, you've probably seen that too. Let's go on further here. Is this PowerPoint storyboarding thing that Microsoft introduced. It has been used at many companies, and especially also in movies, to communicate ideas, because at this stage, no developer had written a line of code, and you're trying to simulate the whole flow through the application. It's not about the one dialogue or something. It's about a flow through the application. This is a sample application that uses a Windows phone, where you can actually tell the customer, okay, did I understand you correct? This is how the first screen might look like. Then you would click, then a new window opens, then this happens, then this, then you have to enter that. So you can simulate kind of a running software. He looks at it and he will tell you, no, please change this and this and that. And you have not taken any developer and any development time actually to develop this. So this is something a product owner or requirements engineer would do. And you've probably seen storyboard in action. Who has seen storyboarding in action? Just a couple of guys. Where were you yesterday? Were you here yesterday? Oh, most, just a couple of you? What's happening here? Okay, then let's go to the storyboarding demo. First question, why is it PowerPoint driven? Because people that are targeted by this know how to use PowerPoint. Those people are not developers, right? They know how to use Excel, Outlook, and PowerPoint. That's kind of about it. Maybe Notepad if we add it to the rule. So you can open up PowerPoint. You have the storyboarding tab, which is installed by Visual Studio. Or you can go through the new web access and start over here. So if you create a new requirement on the backlog, new shiny reports is our new requirement. You can start storyboarding right from a idea. So when you add things to the product backlog in web access, it's considered to be an idea first because it only has a title. It's not refined enough. And at some point, you will add things like description, acceptance criteria, and then you go to storyboarding to communicate ideas. Why do we do that? Because text doesn't work. If you ever try to describe requirements in text, first of all, it's not easy. Second of all, it's focusing on the wrong things. And it still can be misinterpreted by everyone else. So we've done a training with three teams out of four developers. They got the same requirements, text-based, and we got three different results. And everyone who read the requirement, oh, this is crystal clear what he wants, right? But it looked totally different. So this wasn't clear enough. So what did the software industry do to solve that problem? Requirements need to have even more text. If we write more, then probably there will be less misunderstanding, right? Have you ever seen a developer reading an 80-page specification? It's called selective reading. You just go over it and look at a few screenshots and a few things that you think are interesting and skip the rest. So this even makes it worse because everyone has a different selection process while they actually reads. So the text should be really short, right? So if you have a good requirement, it might look like the description is maybe in user story syntax as a some kind of user, let's say as a TFS user. TFS user, I want to be able to create shiny reports in order to, and this is the most interesting part because you know who the customer is that raises a requirement. You also know what he told you what he wants, but you haven't asked him what he actually wants, and you have to try to figure that out. If he just tells you things like, please add a column to this list, and please add another column, you can keep adding columns, but you can also ask, why do you want those columns? I think you want to actually do some total different report, and we should create a new view for the whole thing, because you're trying to change one report into something else that you probably need, right? So in order to impress my boss. So now we can talk to that customer and discuss if impressing my boss is a great goal. No, he defines the goals, right? But we can discuss if this is a great way to impress his boss. Okay, those should be printable in black and white and color. Company logo should appear in upper right corner. So we really try to keep very easy and simple on the text side of a requirement definition. Those criteria on the right side are really easy to be executed on, because you can just develop those things like a checklist. If you've developed those couple of bullets, you're done. If you have tested those bullets, you're done. Those are your first test cases later. And now we started the storyboarding, and now we can start drawing your software. Let's imagine we already have a software. You can just see you have all those templates like ribbon applications, the modern ones. If you have an existing software, let's say we want to add a new feature to this great Windows utility. So we can just steal a screenshot from it. And the new requirement could be, the customer has trouble finding the add button. New product backlog item, make it easier to find the add button. Requirement, whatever. So this is the proposal to my client. So this is our current application, dear client, and I will now show you how I imagined the new button to look like. I thought we need a new button somewhere around here. It should be larger than the other buttons. Maybe like this, so you can easier find it. Call it Add Now. Oh, make it really easy to find, which means add a little bit of color to it. How about this? If you really like it, you can save it into your library. Now, if you need more beautiful buttons, you can just add them. Okay, you don't. Good. But we're not talking about one dialogue, right? We're talking about a flow. We're trying to communicate a concept here. So storyboarding is officially creating a concept. So you're trying to tell them, okay, this is where the new button will be. And if you click on it, what would happen? Well, a new pop-up will appear. So I add a new page. I add a new alert dialogue. Something like this. He will ask you if you're sure, because you usually click the wrong thing. You're a user after all. Then you have two options. It's no and cancel. And if you click on no, we will do a hyperlink to another slide, to the next slide. If you go on cancel, we will hyperlink the previous slide. So you're trying to communicate real flow here. And the last slide will have something like this. And error messages usually have only one option, which is OK. Or OK. Like this. But again, we're trying to communicate an idea, right? Before we spend time on development and make expensive people try to develop something, we're not sure we understood it, we can make sure we understood it. Did I understand you correctly, dear client, that you cannot find the add button? Well, let me add your mouse cursor then. Because until that, when you were trying to find the add button, you were really slow. Let me simulate this using an animation. You were always looking, where is this add button, right? And now you can immediately find it. Nice, huh? And then you click on it, and there will be a message box popping up. Is that what you expected? Did you actually want a new pop-up, right? Do you want your company logo on the pop-up? No, no details, please. We want to talk about the whole overall flow, right? We're not talking about details here, dear customer. And now you can choose between cancel, and you go back, or you click on no, and you come to the critical error. And now he can tell me, no, this is not what I want, but we have not spent time in development. Once we are at least sure we know what he thinks he wants to be delivered, then we can engage development, and we do short cycles in continuous integration, continuous delivery, and get it over the fence to show him. Do you see a problem in this approach? I mean, it's a great approach. Use storyboards. New homework for next time. Try storyboarding, right? There's one small problem. If a customer looks at this presentation, he will ask you, why exactly do you need 4 months to develop this? It's working. You just showed me. And you know that PowerPoint can export as an .exe file? I see PowerPoint apps coming up in the next time frame. I don't know why. I think there's VBA support, right, in PowerPoint? Oh, no. So yeah, be careful. It's not a running application. What you can do if you just want to make sure that he doesn't feel it's a real app, there's a link hidden at the bottom of the screen. Find more storyboard shapes online. which will bring up the web page and the Visual Studio Gallery, and you can download more shapes. And especially there's something like storytelling shapes and sketchy shapes. And the sketchy shapes just look like you have drawn and sketched out some dialogue. It's not real controls. So you don't talk about the details, you talk just generally. There will be a dialogue. Doesn't matter how it looked like, right? Just a dialogue and stuff like that. So you want to download those, this is how they look like. And those packages are for free, and install them. Since most of you are developers, I will show you how to install it. Why? Because it took me 20 minutes. Why? Because I'm a developer. So I got this file. It's an 8 SBSX file. So what do you do with it? So I scanned my whole hard drive. There needs to be other files of the same format copied in there. PowerPoint doesn't pick it up. Okay, restart PowerPoint maybe then. It just doesn't work. And then I thought, who's the target audience? Is it a developer? Let's open PowerPoint. Oh, there's an import button? That is easy. Done. It's how a user would use it, not a developer. So you see that tool is not for use by developers, it's for use by requirements people and maybe even customers. And the best part is you don't have to have this add-on installed to just view it, right? So you can just take that PowerPoint file, send it to your customers, they can send you feedback back. They don't have to install anything like this storyboarding ribbon that comes out of Visual Studio. Okay, that's it, storyboarding. If you save that file now, you should make sure you save it somewhere where everyone else on the team can access it, and TFS would like you to use the SharePoint project portal if possible. This would take some time, because if you use SharePoint Dem, he will automatically link it to the product backlog item that you selected. And since we started storyboarding out of this one product backlog item, ID1, he will automatically link those two. How does it look like? Do you want to try this? Is that something you think is valuable? Who wants to try this? Okay, I know who that was, right? Homework for next year. I'll make sure that. And it actually really works, so I wouldn't tell you if it doesn't work, so please try and tell me if it really worked for you. Okay, priorities is another thing, and you can figure that out, but basically priorities means if you have more than a single customer, how do you know what's the most important thing? You cannot ask your customer about priorities. Everything he tells you has a high priority, otherwise he would not tell you, right? They're not telling you with low priority things. And if you go to a customer, you give him 10 requirements and you ask him to bring them in order or in priority, what do you think what you will get back? All 10 are of high priority, priority one. No, I need an order. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, all have priority one. An order, one. You cannot talk with customers about priorities. This doesn't work. Everything is high priority. So the ordering, you have to do an ordering, right? It's like a tunnel with one lane. All 10 cars want to reach the other end of the tunnel, but there's only one lane, so one needs to be first. That's the way it works, right? And hopefully all 10 will arrive at the other end of the tunnel. So anyway, if you have those priorities, you have to find a way, if you have multiple customers, how to agree on an order, how to develop things. So this is a screenshot actually from a Microsoft TFS team where they invited a few customers and asked them what's the most important thing we should do in the next release. And they actually have done it on paper and not with tool support because it's a very early stage of idea management. And there's no real tooling on the Microsoft side for this right now. So you can ask customers, which is always a good idea to do. You can play games with them. You can raise questions. Those are the questions that were asked during that meeting. How important are certain features to your business? How satisfied are you with what is already in the product? And is it in general the right direction, what we just proposed you, if we should go in that direction or not? So you see the ideas or the requirements on the left side and those three categories as columns. And all the customers get to fill out this sheet to help us order, not prioritize, order the product backlog appropriately. And then they put it up on the wall, and you see all those little stickies in green, red, and blue. And then they try to count it and try to find out what the highest ordered items should be for the next few sprints. And of course, it would be nice to have that in TFS. Right now it's on the wall, so you need at least one intern to copy all that into one of your systems. And as you know, in TFS, you have this new product backlog management view, which is just a special view on top of your work items. And you can order things by doing drag and drop. In a browser, drag and drop, it works, and it actually saves your order. And it works with many browsers too. It took Microsoft a little bit. At the end, you will get something like a velocity chart where you can actually count the number of user stories or features or requirements, however you call them, the number of things you implemented in a sprint. And it does not count the amount, it does count the effort field. So whatever you use to estimate those items, those will be to size those items, that will be used as a measure for this chart. So you can see in this chart, we're in sprint 3. We're almost in the middle of implementing all the features we planned for sprint 3. And if you have a velocity, you can calculate something like your most likely velocity, which could be an average or something more cautious than an average. And you can insert that number at the top, and you can see those lines, those cut lines, where you will be after sprint 3, 4, and so on. But this is just to, the tool support is just there to make it transparent, because everyone should see where his requirement is on the whole backlog. So if you have multiple customers, this is really important, so you can see, I'm now number 6, and if a critical bug is more important, I'm now number 7 on the order list. But I can always see why I'm number 7, because those 6 things are more important, at least the product owner thinks that those are more important. If I don't agree, I can still complain, but I have to know where I am and who's more important in order to complain efficiently as a customer. And so make it transparent. This is where TFS helps you. How to talk to your customers? This is where TFS does not help you. Find out and use storyboards to talk with them. Coding and test. This is now the more technical part. And the important thing about coding and tests is you want feedback as early as possible. And this can be technical feedback, user feedback, whatever. When you write a line of code in Visual Studio, you will immediately get the first level of feedback. It's called IntelliSense. IntelliSense is super clever. It tells you, you know what? If you write this, I guarantee the compiler will say no. This is what IntelliSense actually does, right? It does autocomplete while you write and tells you the earliest level of feedback. You don't even have to compile. I know it will not work. I, your IntelliSense helper. And then there's a compiler, obviously, but he's not too clever, right? The compiler does only say, well, it basically compiles, but I can't guarantee that it actually starts, which is not really enough, right? It's like a spell check in Word. Doesn't really tell you the text is correct. So then you have to add that level of unit testing. This is really important because code doesn't check itself. And if you write a line of code and you think you're doing the right thing, it could be, but it's very human what we do here, writing code. If two developers write the same line of code, it could look different, or the same few lines of code, it could be a different thing. So you really have to add some way of validating, is that correct what I've just written, to really prove that it's correct. And unit testing is the only thing that I think is there in your arsenal of tools to do that. It's not that I like unit testing, it's just more do you have a better idea how to test your code? I don't. So we might have to do it. Who's doing unit testing, actually? Oh, a little bit less than half of the room. Okay, which is good, actually. Pretty good outcome. Using code coverage? Over 80%? Who thinks that matters? Huh, interesting. Be careful if just one metric matters enough. But anyway, so if you do testing and you force your developers to do some form of automated test, which gives you a lot of benefits, the self-documentation of a test, because if you look at your test, you see how the code should actually behave. It's like a technical documentation to your running code. So if you have those tests and you have production code, what should you write first? Test? Why do you say that? What's your favorite reason to do that, maybe?
Because you don't write unnecessary code?
Yeah, you will be look nicer probably because you're the first user and you will not add any unnecessary gold plating, how it's called, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
Unless you write a test? You actually write a test?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
right, from a timing perspective, yes. So if you write a test first, the test cannot be cut off. Awesome, isn't it? It's such a small and simple solution. My personal favorite, why I would start with tests, and I did not like a few years ago, is a very simple thing. If you have two things in life, and one is fun and one is not, what do you think the appropriate order would be to do it? It's a philosophy. Yeah, it's definitely a philosophy question. It might be that you actually like to write tests, right? So personally, for me, I hate writing unit tests,
And so for me, it's very clear I have to start with this. If I don't, it's like, I can do the unit test tomorrow. And tomorrow, is it more fun? I can do it in the afternoon, right? And you just keep pushing it because you don't want to do it, right? If you do the ugly part first, it's all good. So yes, you have to have some form of automatic tests at this stage to be sure that your code is actually doing what you think it's doing. And it's something the developer has to do, or someone else, some other developer. You can even have a second developer do unit testing against the code of a different developer. That's also pretty neat, actually. I've seen a Scrum team where they have, it was like a computer game. I thought they were playing some shooter game or anything. So one was writing unit tests, one was writing the code. And they were screaming and shouting all the time. It was like a computer game. So maybe this is an idea you want to try out. Have two people code against the same interface and one tries to break what the other has just written. It's also a nice team sport for software development. Then we have the check-in, obviously. And maybe you have a nice comment or a work item associated with it. And the check-in ideally triggers a continuous build, so you can be sure that you have not left out a file and that it still compiles and even works on the build server, not only on the client side. So now we have a checked-in version that seems to technically work, but we don't know if it works altogether, so we have to have some form of integration testing. And at some point, we have to find out if it actually does what the customer wants and if it's fast enough and stable enough, system performance and other tests. And then the user acceptance test. So somewhere between check-in and the build server says it's good and the customer looks at it, we have to automatically deploy that stuff. And this is where this lab management part comes in. You want to deploy it right into a test lab. So when I talk about continuous delivery and continuous deployment, yes, of course, it can be any system. It could be production. It could be a test system. But I think in most cases, it's not the developer checking in on a production machine. So you deploy into something like a pre-production where your final testing can take place. And then there are other scripts probably that will really take it into production. That's what I think, but you're free to do that. And then there's something like operational acceptance where you actually install it on production and check out if it still works, hopefully. And obviously you know that the longer you wait and the longer the feedback cycles are, this increases the cost of error. Because if IntelliSense tells you this is wrong what you're doing, you're immediately alerted. If it's like a user telling you weeks later, you have to go back, open the old code, read it again, try to get in the old mood in that code and really grog it, and it takes at least half an hour to be back. So if you have unit testing and the new Visual Studio has this continuous code, continuous test runner piece, that means you write a little bit of code and all the unit tests get re-executed. So you will immediately get feedback. Let's say you write some lines of code in this file, and then all the unit tests get executed in this Test Explorer window, and you will immediately see the first one is failing. So something I just changed is wrong. And that continuous test runner runs after every compile. So you have to compile, and then he will run all the tests if you want to. And then you still do a few more changes to the code, and then he will run again, and will show you how it works. And this time, it looks pretty good. So if you have... So don't think about, should I start with unit tests? Think about, how cool would it be if I have unit tests that actually give me that level of feedback, right? While I write code, they will tell me that I just have screwed up something in a total different edge of my software, which I would not be aware of because it's a whole complex module. How cool would that be? It's not cool writing a unit test. It's cool to have them. That's the difference. So we have to try to... Well, it might actually be cool to write a test. It's not right. It might be fun. It's just I don't like it. It's all good. And I still do it, right? You can still add code reviews if you want. You've probably seen that Visual Studio has a nice little code review feature now where you can do discussions on code and do code reviews together. Are you doing code reviews, by the way? Yep. Is it like a regular basis thing? You meet with a whole team or just two people together? Or
every check-in?
Every check-in? Oh, every check-in. Wow. You work for the government or something? No? Oh, you do. Ah, oh, see, now I know. Now I got it. Okay. So still in Visual Studio, it's allowed to do pair programming, and you can even have multiple people looking at the same monitor that still works. They have not stopped you from doing that anyhow. You can still sit together and look at the same screen. But if you can't do that for whatever reason, or you want it as an audit trail to really know when somebody has code reviewed it, then you might want to look at the code review process that requires Team Foundation Server in Visual Studio to go through a code review. So while you do all the coding, right? So you have coding and unit testing, and you probably look at the task board every day. You will do daily Scrum meetings, hopefully, or daily meetings to synchronize yourself. Why would you do that? Because in modern software development with short cycles, you need to find out where you are, and it's only the team that can find out, are we still on track? Can we still meet our goals for this running iteration, for this running sprint? So usually, we would say it's maximum 15 minutes. It can also be done after 7 if you want to. And you ask those three questions, right? What have you done since the last meeting, last daily Scrum meeting? What will you do between now and the next daily Scrum meeting? And was there anything in your way? So the third question is, again, a feedback mechanism. So every day, the team asks the question, has anyone here in our team a problem? Is there anything we need to fix, get out of your way to make you more productive? Or are you 100% productive? So you could also rephrase the question into, dear team members, are you 100% productive today? And if not, tell us why. Because I don't like the other team member X, or my server is too slow, whatever. It can be process, people, tool. And you try to find that out here. So on a daily basis, you see if there are any impediments to the flow of delivering new features. The first two questions, obviously, to find out, are we still in plan and what are we doing right now? Are two people working on the same code or not, if you have a team? It's not a status meeting in the classical sense, because there's no project manager whom you report how far you are and how good you've done and progressed. It's more about the team talks to itself. So the question, should somebody who's not part of the development team be part of this meeting? They want to, of course. Every project manager wants to be part of every meeting that has to do with progress. But have you seen what happens if you have, let's say, a Scrum team and a project manager enters the room for that meeting? First of all the estimates change. They want to be more friendly and they're starting to lie. And they always talk to him. They're not talking to the team anymore, like, we as a team, how far are we? They're just talking to him. Yes, sir. I've done a lot yesterday. Yes, I'm 80%. Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow, yeah, I'm sure I'm finished tomorrow. Yes, yes. I'm not sure this is what we want out of this meeting. I want the team to find a place each day to discuss who's changing what today. Can somebody help someone else on the team? So ideally, don't have the product owner attend and don't solve the problems. If you have any problem that needs to be discussed, you can add another meeting, but don't solve the problems during that meeting. It's just ask everyone the same questions, everyone answers, meeting is done, and then you can add small problem-solving meetings if you want. And again, the product owner should not attend. It doesn't mean that it doesn't work. Maybe you have a good product owner that gets that the team is responsible for progress. Maybe you have a product owner that you're taking a picture for your product owner. Awesome. You're really getting those slides. Should I put some official logos on it so that it looks more official maybe for you? Yes. So in your case, actually, product owner must not attend, right? I've seen Scrum teams where it actually worked having the product owner there, just because the product owner didn't care how far they are and how they progress. He was just introducing new requirements. He told, I talked with a customer last week, and this is what he told me about the next sprint. So he's telling like what's new on the backlog, and he was not interfering with the current sprint. So this worked really well, but it was more like him informing the team about new requirements. So it can work, but ideally, if it's a team that had a project manager and he's still the product owner, you might consider not inviting him. So who's responsible to make sure he's not invited? The Scrum Master. Poor guy. Yes. This is what you learn in those Scrum Master courses, like, how do I not invite my own boss and things like that. This is what you need the certificate for, probably. So during a daily Scrum, you might want to look at a task board if you want. This is the new task board of Visual Studio 2012 from the TFS. This is only available on the website, because you can easily open up on any laptop, on any browser that you have, and you don't have to install Visual Studio or anything. And some teams actually use this board to update the status during daily sprints and daily Scrum meetings. So what you would do then is set the person filter. This is very important. You select a person, because maybe we have a projector like here, and it's just the whole team standing in front. So they do not log out and log in. They just set the person filter to who he is, and then they can move things, and then they will be automatically assigned and the name will appear right over here. Task board, you might want to use that for your daily scrum meetings, and many teams I've met show the burndown chart as the last thing of a daily scrum meeting. So the burndown chart uses whatever unit you are using to estimate your tasks, like hours, for example. And it tells you on the first day of the sprint of this running iteration, you told us that, or you estimated it will be 115 kind of about hours for the whole team. And then each day it's counting the remaining work. Those are weekends, by the way, the darker ones. So somebody worked on Sunday here. So this is not a typical diagram. It's not a typical diagram because of many things on here. Because usually, on the first day of the sprint, did you really find out every work that you have to do for this sprint? No. On day two, you add the rest. And then you start developing. Then you figure out, oh my God, we're really slow. And then even worse, you figure out you forgot something. You find more additional work. And then you have to hurry a lot. Like this. This is more realistic, a typical burned-out chart. And then the question comes up if it actually helps if it looks like that. But let the team decide, and you can discuss it at the end of each daily scrum meeting. Are we still on track is the question. If you're not on track, you should alert your product owner because he's not there, so you have to alert him. So you look at the burn-on chart altogether and ask the question, are we still on track? Okay, so we have set our ideas and priorities. We have coded and tested. And at the end, we need to do a second pass of testing, which is exploratory testing. So the point we're trying to solve here is that classical testing, like unit testing, is something you have to do to make sure your code is technically correct. Then there's integration testing, that it all works together. Then there's like system testing, that it's fast enough and stuff like that. But have you actually tried to find out if the customer is happy with it? And it's not a great idea to let the customer try out if he's happy with it. You should at least once have tested things even before and try to simulate your customer before you give it out to a customer. I'm not sure if this is common in our industry, though. Sometimes I have the feeling the customer is the first level of exploratory testing. And exploratory testing also means you do not have test cases. You do not have a clear plan what you're testing. You maybe know what module you want to emphasize your tests on, but you're not going into detail because the test cases you have are things that you already expect. And we're trying to find the unexpected here, things that a customer cares about but we did not think about. So you should always reserve time during a sprint for exploratory testing. Some teams call it a chaos test, which probably makes more sense. Somebody just clicking through the application. Which is what the developer does anyway, right? I hope he once clicks through the application, but he always clicks the same path, right? Have you seen a developer presenting at a code review at the end of a sprint? So I had one of those super genius senior developers presenting in front of customers, and he was clicking really slow. And I know he's the fastest clicker on earth. So I asked him, why are you clicking so slow? After the customers have left, obviously, right? Why the hell are you clicking so slow? Well, sometimes it crashes otherwise. A developer does not want to crash his software. Why would he? It's his baby. He just developed it. Why would he destroy it? He's trying to build test cases and everything that work. He's not the type of destroyer guy. This is where we need testers. People who have this emotion to break things. Yeah, it's like the dark side of magic. No, it's actually not, but you know what I mean. We need just a different focus. It's just, and it's obviously about focus, because if I develop something, I don't even see mistakes in there. And you know how many times I have a team developing, presenting at the review, at the sprint review at the end, and having like typos, like spelling mistakes everywhere, and they don't even see it? Or they have a new dialogue that still says Form 1 as title. There were four developers. It was perfectly tested. Nobody realized. Because they were so focused on the new functionality, and like the customer, hey, what's Form 1? And they're like, we see that for the first time. And we've tested for 2 weeks. Because they're focused. They're very much focused on what they do. And this is okay. This is how a developer works. But this is where we need a tester, somebody else on the team who does this. He should just do a second pass of, I'm a customer trying to use this software in whatever order. Does it still work? And if you do that, this is one of the screenshots in the slide deck, but let me just show you what's really important about it. The really important part about this is it does not take too much time. And I think that's important, because if we think about short cycles, the only thing you don't have in a sprint is time. You always need a test plan, though. A test plan would be everything you want to test for a sprint, for example. So this is test plan for sprint one. Let me book this on release one, sprint one. Let's go into that test plan. Oh, by the way, there's automatic logic. He knows when you will be done with testing already. This is part of Microsoft Test Manager. It's today plus 7 days. And yes, you can change this, but not in this dialogue, because this would be intuitive. So this is Microsoft Test Manager. And as you probably know, this has been around for a version already, for TFS 2010. And you can create test cases and test steps and test configurations and test settings. You can spend hours in here planning your test strategy and thinking and doing things. On the other hand, in the new agile world, sometimes a sprint has a length of 2 weeks. 2 weeks means 10 working days minus meetings. So you have maybe 9 working days left. In those 9 working days, you have to implement new features, test those features, make sure you have not destroyed anything else that was initially working in that software, so test the whole thing again. Do some code refactoring and increase your code quality if everything has gone bad. 9 days, that is not a lot. So you don't have too much time to spend. And there's a new mode in this test manager, which means right-click and let me start testing. Start testing is now called Explore, just if you're wondering. But and Explore just minimizes test manager, opens up test runner, and you can just start. And it will now record video and audio. It's really important to get the audio from your testers, him swearing and stuff like that. You have to feel the pain of your tester as a developer to actually understand what you've done wrong. This is why they built this tool. But the great part, again, it took me like now 10 seconds to just create a test plan and start testing without any more details. And now we can start testing the software, which is obviously this great piece of software. And now we can, 9 plus 1 plus 1... Hey, why is 9 plus 1 11? I think that's a bug. So 9 plus 1 should be 10, not 11. So we think we found a bug. We can use rich formatting here. This is something you should not show that your testers, that it's actually possible. Then you can create add screenshots to it. Obviously, a good tester has a good feeling what's the important part of the screen to photograph for a bug report. I don't know, maybe the clock. Maybe the recycle bin. If you run an older version of Windows, you can photograph the start menu. And you should actually do that, because there will be no start menu soon, as you know, right? If you upgrade to a new version. So it makes sense to photograph that too. No, and maybe you do the real photograph of the interesting part. And now you can double-click your screenshots if you want to edit them in a professional graphic software. If you have that installed, if you don't, then Microsoft Paint will open and you can give some subtle notes in it where to find the bug. Just helping your developers a little bit where to focus. Maybe giving them some more clues about how you feel. So when you save it, you will see all your red ink on the screenshot. So this is now actually your bug report, so you can create a bug out of this. And the interesting part from a Scrum, a process perspective, is you only have to supply a title now. So he has seen all the clicks you've done. They're automatically written down. He actually did screenshots on every of my clicks. He pressed keyboard Windows R. He typed calc in the open combo box. This is where it was. Then he clicked on this button on the lower right corner. So you get all the screenshots and all this stuff. Isn't that nice? So the whole steps to reproduce thing, you cannot do any mistakes as a tester. You cannot forget anything. It's just there. And all you need now is a title. And this is Microsoft Test Manager, right? And Microsoft Test Manager used to be Visual Studio Ultimate only, but now it's part of Premium. So everyone who has Visual Studio Premium has Test Manager and can just start testing. bug 9 plus 1 should be temp. Who should do this? Well, me probably. And the default, if I save this, is not save bug and close. It's save and create a test case. Because now where you find a bug, you might want to be more structured for the next time and redo that test case every time when you release the software. And he has written all these steps for you. So there's no need to write a test case at all. You can just use exploratory testing. Click through your application. You don't have to create a bug for this. You can directly go to create test case. And it writes the test cases out for you. And now you can go through them and click through them again. That saves you time. It's clicking instead of typing kind of thing. Tests that add works great. You might want to add expected result. Should be 10, not 11. And you could, in theory, just continue exploratory with the exploratory testing session or end testing and go back to Test Manager. He will tell you that your session lasted 1 minute 41 seconds. You found and discovered one bug and one test case during your session. And if you go back to your test plan, you see the one test case, which is just part of the plan. It's very unstructured, but since we just started in a few seconds without preparing anything. But now we can get more structured by adding requirements. We can now add our new shiny reports product backlog item. And we can drag and drop the new test case into our requirement folder here. And now the test case is automatically linked correctly. So the test case knows I'm actually testing product backlog item 1. And I'm testing the bug, obviously, too. And product backlog item 1 knows I have one test case. And it's test that add works great. So you just started with not too much time. Just start Test Manager. If you find a bug, you don't have to write too much. You're not spending time. Because after all, as a tester, you don't know if you can reproduce the bug or the developer can reproduce the bug. And you don't know if that bug will ever be, from an ordering perspective on the backlog, from a priority perspective, be in the first few items so that it actually goes into the next sprint. Maybe we will never fix that bug because we decide it's not an important one. So this is why we should not spend too much time when creating bug reports, but we still want all the information. And if you look at that bug in Visual Studio, for example, first of all, it looks beautiful, obviously, because of the color and size. We've seen the screenshots already. We will get something like system information. We could have the video recorded with audio, as I said. We can have additional attachments like IntelliTrace. If you run Visual Studio Ultimate, you want the full debugger stack trace, you can get that. So you get a lot of information out of it. And you get it for all application types, right? Because, I mean, it's a video, after all. It can record whatever application you start. It's not limited to .NET. The Microsoft .NET framework limitations is only if you're using IntelliTrace. This requires you to have a .NET framework application. Okay, so you should really plan time for exploratory testing. Have somebody who has not developed that feature click through the application, simulate user behavior, and a real tester knows how to do that. You know, my favorite bug report was if you take the scroll bar, an extremely fast scroll up and down, then it will crash your app. I tried to reproduce it as a developer. How did he find that out as a tester? What do you do? How do you use your computer? But I've seen that in real life too. So there are testers that do, they call it monkey testing, and they just take a keyboard and just clap around it and like, oh, let's see if it crashes. We'll find out. Let's see what happens. So try to get to some state that was not expected. Okay, you have a few screenshots to remember what I just showed you, created a new test case, and stuff like that. So at the end, if you use this approach and at some point you have test cases, you can get a nice report out of Team Foundation Server. And all that reports and all that features I'm showing you are not limited to Scrum or something. You can do whatever process you like. You still get those features out of TFS. So this report shows you your requirements as a hierarchy. In green, you see the task completion rate. And then at the right side, you get results from Microsoft Test Manager and even if bugs were already created and the status of those bugs. So getting a lot of information from all the different subsystems, like from the work items and requirements, from the task, from the task board, the test results from Test Manager and the bug tracking, all in one report that tries to give you the ALM overview, kind of. So how is my life cycle doing? Do I have any process problems in my cycle? Okay, we've tested it, and now we deploy it to production. So once in production, you actually want to monitor things. This is one of the live dashboards that Microsoft is using. What I like about this dashboard for the Team Foundation service is that they actually have a Twitter integration on the right side. Not that I would use Twitter, but what they found out is that if the service is not running, they're receiving complaints through Twitter and through email before any of the automatic monitoring tools finds that. Because people are just faster, right? You click somewhere, you get an error, you just write an email, why is it not working? So they get emails and Twitter first, and then like after 2 or 3 minutes, their internal monitoring system starts to tell them, I think there's something wrong. But it's the users are the fastest way to get you an alert that something's not working in production. This is why they added the Twitter feed on here as well. So you see some KPIs and stuff, and you really want to have those nice dashboards. And if you run on Windows Azure, of course, you get a few of those already. It's important to monitor your website. If you do website and web services projects, if you do something like a classical Windows application, you would still want to have some metrics back. It's more complicated because it's not your server, right? It's running on some user machine. But you still want to have exceptions automatically reported to you. You would still want to have usage statistics to see how often is what module used. And you would use that as a product owner to prioritize, to order your product backlog. If you know what is used more frequently, this is the area you want to spend more time on improving, maybe. Or maybe improve the other areas that are not used because for that reason. It depends, again. But you need numbers to be able to decide, especially if you have a lot of customers. Another thing you can do, if your application is not behaving as expected and it's a production machine, you can download an IntelliTrace collector. As you know, for IntelliTrace, you need Visual Studio Ultimate to open those files. But the collector is for free and it's a small .exe file you can install on any production machine, and you can start logging IntelliTrace data, which means automatic log file from .NET Framework and the whole stack trace and all the parameters to the methods and the return values. So as an administrator, you can download this and start the recording. Be careful because recording creates huge files. So you don't want to record for 24 hours or anything. It's more like a 15-minute recording that you should target. And then you get a huge iTrace file back. You can send that back to developers. You need at least one Visual Studio Ultimate to open it. Hopefully you still have your PDB files that you have stored somewhere so it can give you the connection back to your source code. And then you can debug on your machine, like a historical debugger function, even if this was weeks ago. And it will open the correct code from TFS and show you what actually happened. You can step through the whole recording. Pretty neat thing. You should check it out. So the third kind of integration, to operations in Visual Studio is the System Center integrations. Anyone using System Center products at all? Or his company? Not a lot. This is kind of typical right now. Microsoft has those admin products, right? They target the administrator. And if you have not looked at it, you should probably do that. So let's assume I'm a lazy administrator. Not that all administrators are lazy, but if I would be an administrator, I would be lazy. You have 400 computers running around, and you're supposed that they all work, kind of, right? So when any of your Windows applications starts crashing, I would buy System Center, and I would have such a console, so I see all my servers or clients, and I see the alerts in the last 24 hours, which is the top part. And then you can right-click things and say set resolution state assigned to engineering, I mean forwards to development team, right? And then it pops up a new item on Team Foundation server on the development side. I'm not sure this is really good because the admins will just sit there in their nice comfy chair and just forward everything to development so they don't have to do anything. But it will open up a new item on Team Foundation server of type operational issue. That's how it's called. And you will get a lot of information. Again, you get IntelliTrace, you get system information, you get the exception message from the .NET Framework. So everything that you as a developer would care, what was the machine name and stuff. And then you can do the regular check-in and fixing. And once you set the state accordingly, your admin will be alerted. Now the second list here shows you alerts resolved by engineering. And he can now retry if the problem is still there, if the problem is gone, install the new version of the software, and then he will see if it actually worked. So this is the integration during operations of your software. Then, I'm not sure if you've seen this so far, there is a third-party tool integrated in Visual Studio. It used to be the .obfuscator that you probably know for code obfuscation that was always there in Visual Studio. And the company that built that obfuscation technique, they built a new tool which is called Preemptive Analytics. And they added, of course, it can still do .obfuscation, but they added something new. They added automatic exception reporting. So you set up a web service that is publicly facing on the internet maybe, or in your internal organization. And when your application crashes, it introduces all the global exception handlers. It will create a new bug in Team Foundation server. So all the crashes will come to your TFS. Not all the crashes will create a new work item, because otherwise you will get a large database. But they have some rules, like if it's the same kind of crash and the same hour, it's just one bug and stuff like that. But you will get automatic error reporting. If you don't want to build this yourself, Preemptive Analytics might be a way to go. It's not super easy because there are a lot of things you have to prepare and set up the rules and stuff. But once it's working, you get what you want. And there's an lab, an hands-on lab, as part of the virtual machine that you can download on the Microsoft website, so you can actually see what steps you have to do to get it working. So automated error reporting for your .NET applications using Preemptive Analytics. This is how you can find it, by the way. You go into the TFS admin console, and there's a node called Additional Tools and Components, and there's Preemptive Analytics, and you have to install or to click the install link from there. It's not really in your downloaded part. You have to download a separate installer for it. Okay, we have delivered it. We are sure that it runs on the site, and we are monitoring it that it still runs. And now we are going to the user, and we're trying to ask him, is it what you actually wanted? Does it look familiar? A little bit? So meeting the expectations of a user, and meeting is not our goal. Meeting is our minimum goal. It would be delighting would be a good goal, right? And we have to find out, and we have to ask the user. So this is why we do the short cycles, right? We've done storyboarding to not have any misunderstandings in the requirements and goals. But now we're showing him the first version, hopefully after 2 weeks or so, and asking him, is that what you actually wanted? And he will tell, yeah, almost, but you have to change this, this, and that, and then you can make those changes. So small and incremental changes, short cycles. And you can, of course, use the exploratory feedback tool and the exploratory testing tool for feedback that you've just seen. But if you don't want to buy a license for a user, which makes sense, then you can also request feedback. And you start the feedback process right from your team homepage on the web. And there's a request feedback link. And there are a few limitations, though. The first limitation, your customer must be known to your Team Foundation server, so he really has an account. So it's more like the internal stakeholder that you want to ask for feedback. It's not like somebody on the web can connect to your TFS. It's more, okay, I know that guy who should give me feedback because I'm asking myself, actually. I'm asking myself for feedback, and now I have to provide installation instructions or how should the user access the application. TFS does not care about that, so you have to supply either a website or a remote machine, which is remote desktop, or you have pre-installed it somewhere on this computer. Okay, I have pre-installed this software I want to test. Let me use this. This is where I've pre-installed my software. Now you can write a few sentences to describe how to access the application. Dear customer, just click the link. Even you should be able to do that. Oh no, let's move that. And then you have one or multiple items where you want the customer to focus on when he gives feedback. You're not selecting requirements or product backlog items here, because sometimes you're creating 3, 4, 5 features and then you go to the customer once and say, okay, those 5 features altogether make something bigger. focus your feedback on that part of your software, right? It's not about the small, tiny features we've just implemented. It's about the whole thing. So this is why I would say, please focus on add functionality. So under the hood, Team Foundation Server will create a feedback request work item. You can ask multiple stakeholders the same question, and each stakeholder that answers will create a feedback response work item as a child work item below the feedback request work item. Now he will send out an email to the customer. Dear customer, you have been selected, blah, blah, blah. Let's just send it first, and we will find it in a minute. I have a local web server here. We're just waiting for the email to drop in. The feedback client is available on the Microsoft Download Center, so you don't have to buy a license or buy the software. You can just download the feedback client, but you have to have admin permissions to install it once. So you have to really make sure the software is correctly installed. It's not an X-copy deployment or anything like that. Okay, so the user needs to be part of your Active Directory or known to your TFS. You have to have admin permissions to install the feedback client. And you have to have a direct connection to your TFS to submit the feedback and create the feedback request work item. And while this takes a few seconds, I can also show you that once you install the feedback client, you can also just start it. And if you just start it without being requested to do so, you can still give feedback. It's called voluntary feedback, right? You don't have to wait until somebody asks you to focus on feedback on something. So you could also use it as a kind of a bug reporting tool if you wanted to. Why would you do that? Because you can, again, add video and audio recording. This is not for every of your users, right? You don't want every user to send you bug reports with full video and audio, I guess. But there might be some more close inner circle users where you want that. So you can integrate them. Okay, it's still not here, but let me start. Yeah, I have a problem with my internet here, but let me start the voluntary mode. And it looks a little bit like Microsoft's Test Manager and the exploratory testing that we've done. We have to explicitly turn on the screen or voice or both recording. The screen is only recording the first screen if you have multiple screens. And then you just click through a website, for example, through TFS. And then you can make screenshots. It's the same thing, essentially, but you only get video, audio, and screenshot functionality. And of course, you can vote for everything. It's very important that you can vote for things. You know it from Amazon and other sites, giving 1 to 5 stars to things. Same here, you can vote on everything you've been asked for. Even if you have not been asked for, you can rate things. And you can decide between 1 and 5 stars. Like 4 means 4 stars. Oh, yeah, okay. Next. Well, there's a real name behind it, but it doesn't show. So now we will show you all the feedback that you've just provided. In this case, it's a voluntary feedback. You see that it will directly send to your TFS. So he will package a file and send it to your Team Foundation server. Let's go back and find out if we received feedback. Go to work items. There is feedback already, and we even have a query. So this is our inbox for feedback. So we see the new feedback response work item. Since he has not responded to our feedback request but give us voluntary feedback, there's no request as a parent item. You see the video. You can start it from here. And you can now go to links and say, because of this feedback, I want to act upon it, and I want to create a new bug in the system or a new product backlog item. So let's create a new product backlog item, which is related, and call it add more color to the product. And now we have a new product backlog item that will be on the backlog, and it always remembers that it was actually originating from that feedback we received from a client. So if anyone asks us why this is so important and high on our backlog, because we put it on the order one, on the first position, because we received this feedback from one of our clients. So it's all linked, and all the feedbacks from your customers can be saved in a structured way on the system. Again, a few screenshots to look at this so you remember what I just showed you. This is a website I was testing. And this is almost it. In the Update 1 of Visual Studio, there were a few nice new features like a Kanban board to visualize your stories. There's a new diagram, although this is psychologically not too well diagram because it always goes up. And it's not good if things go always up. And it's not very realistic too, right? What goes always up? Maybe depth or something. So we have a lot of TFS sessions coming up today. The next one is about UI animation. I will do one where I talk more about the Scrum process and how to do that with TFS. And there's also one for IntelliTrace if you want to use it in a production environment and then use Visual Studio Ultimate to open those IntelliTrace logs. I hope you will remember your homework as usual. We will check upon next year or the year after. We'll see. I hope there was something new and interesting for you. I try to put every of the new features in scope so that you understand why Microsoft are building those tools. But I have not told you the best part. Microsoft is actually using that kind of software they give us, those tools. They are actually doing Scrum now, or something they call Scrum. They have 3 weeks in which they develop new features. It's only the Visual Studio team. We're not talking about Windows and Office, but the Visual Studio team does Scrum. They're using this. So this diagram, their own employees say they can't see it anymore, because they see it every day. It's like the start of the day. Where are we? How well are we doing in the cycle time and stuff? But they're actually trying to make this possible. If it works, we don't know. We'll see. As you know, Visual Studio has now updates every 3 months, and Team Foundation Server 2, and on the web, on the Windows Azure hosted TFS, every 3 weeks. So every 3 weeks on Monday, you have a few new features on the website. That is Scrum in real life. So let's see if it works. Hopefully it will. And hopefully you can have the same success at some point using shorter cycles. And have fun at the conference. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.